is rated LGBT Radio, starring your host, Rob Watson!
Welcome, welcome, welcome to Rated LGBT Radio. Thank you for tuning in. Please do subscribe, tell your friends, have them subscribe, have them tell their friends, have them subscribe. We love subscribers. And you can find us on any podcast platform you choose to use. Today we have a great show lined up for you. It is around a brand new documentary that is about to have its U.S. theatrical premiere. The documentary is called Much Ado About Dying, and it is the story of a gay uncle's dramatic swan song, and his nephew, who is also the filmmaker, who is right by his side and documenting the whole last years of this very dynamic, theatrical uncle's life. That filmmaker is Simon Chambers. Simon is waiting in the wings here to talk to us. This all started years ago when Simon received an email from his Uncle David, and Uncle David, in pure Uncle David fashion, as you will find out if you watch the film, said, "I think I may be dying." And Simon took that as a summons to get to the UK where Uncle David was to take care of him. He wasn't actually quite dying at the time, but it started the journey with Simon and Uncle David for the end of Uncle David's life. And Simon, the talented documentary filmmaker that he is, documented the whole thing. So we get to meet and understand Uncle David in this really poignant film. For the next 5 years, Simon was with him documenting it, and that everything he captured was from Uncle David's performance exuberance, where he would act out passages of Shakespeare, i.e. Uncle David was a talented actor, and that didn't stop. Plus the harder parts where he was swinging from being boisterous and humorous to very short-tempered, and then the different physical and mental challenges that happen at end of life. Simon, like I said, is present for the whole thing, documents it, and actually becomes part of the film himself. So we are going to talk about that today. And before we get to Simon, we are going to call on Mr. Brody Levesque. Brody is the editor of the Los Angeles Blade magazine and also producer of the show. And Brody is waiting in the wings for some news stories that are happening right now as we speak. Brody, welcome to the show.
Hey, Rob. Thank you. And good afternoon, good morning, or good day to those of you who are listening to the show anywhere around the globe. I want to point out that today is the State of the Union address by President Joe Biden to Congress. It is the annual address, which is actually a constitutional requirement, that the President of the United States gives to give lawmakers basically a kind of a overview of what's happened over the previous year, and more importantly, what the goals and aims of the administration and the government is moving forward. This year, of course, obviously, there is a tremendous amount of interest in this particular State of the Union. This will be the president facing, again, a rather hostile Republican majority held House, although I will note that Speaker Mike Johnson, in several meetings with his caucus, has specifically asked them to maintain the decorum of the House. In other words, the representatives from Georgia, Colorado, Texas, and Alabama are asked to refrain from literally making asses out of themselves like they've done in previous years. We will see if they respect the speaker's request. The president tonight is expected to talk about the economy. The president is also expected to address specifically LGBTQ issues. We will have the full coverage of that and other portions of the State of the Union up at the Los Angeles Blade later today. I have my White House reporter, Chris Kane, who will be reporting on the State of the Union address along with the rest of the Washington Press Corps. And we will be putting Chris's stories up as he files them later on today. So watch the LosAngelesBlade.com for these stories as we get them up. Let me shift to some of the other stories that we are covering. LGBTQ advocacy group GLAAD released a poll today that found that 94% of LGBTQ Americans are highly motivated to vote, and those that were residing in seven swing states are showing preference over the president versus Donald Trump by a margin of 57 points. The data was pulled from a national survey that was conducted. Overall, 53% of all respondents who are LGBTQ plus are backing the president. So that was one of the things that we made a note of as we come out of Super Tuesday, which was, as you know, on Tuesday. The two front runners now, without a doubt, hands down, it's pretty much settled. It is a Biden-Trump rematch. Same as what we saw in 2020. So you're going to see a lot of push by both parties and especially by various groups as we start to move towards November. Right now, the president's polling is grim. He and former President Trump are literally within the margin of error, with President Trump polling slightly ahead of Mr. Biden. The president is taking hits on Gaza, immigration, and the crisis at the U.S. southern border. He's also taking hits on the economy, which is a little unfair because the economy is actually in a stronger position than it was under President Trump. However, inflation continues to remain an issue with voters. The other thing the president's getting hit on is the age issue. And that, of course, can also be fairly said. The Republican front runner over this past weekend, he had his, as we would say in the press, senior moments. But the voters seem to be mostly driven towards the immigration crisis at the U.S. border and the economy. So we'll have to wait to see how that pulls out. Reflective of that, a major poll that was run earlier this week by seven major polling organizations averaged together, the president's not doing a good job, according to most Americans. So there will be kind of a big push, not only by the campaign, but also by the White House itself in messaging. And again, this will also probably be reflected in tonight's State of the Union address before Congress. Just a couple of other things to note. Los Angeles Blade media partner Media Matters just released a new study, and this is important. YouTube, which is, of course, Alphabet Google-owned, is allowing right-wing creators, and these are people with millions of subscribers, to continue to misgender and deadname trans people on its platform. And they continue to allow that to go on and at the same time be monetized. And the problem is that if anyone else were to do that, it would be in violation of YouTube's stated community standards. So in today's Los Angeles Blade, I published a report from Media Matters. I'll let you folks go look at it. It is fairly illuminating as to the amount of basically transphobic stuff that's being put out on that platform. So So I guess that's kind of looking at it in that regard. And at the same time, you know, we also have to pay attention to other things. Yesterday, Rob, there was a demonstration in Ottawa, Oklahoma, by the Westboro Baptist Church. Actually, I should note, less than seven members of the Westboro Baptist Church actually showed up. But across the street were 400-plus supporters of the queer community. Now, the reason they were there was because at the beginning of the month of February, a young trans, non-binary person died as a result of a violent episode in a bathroom in the school. They still haven't released the autopsy results, so it cannot be absolutely determined that the cause of death was a direct result of the beating. However, it was directly.
Which I'll point out was the subject of our show last week. But go ahead, Brian.
Last week, right. But it is also one of those things that people need to understand that the transphobia, especially as I just talked about on YouTube, filters itself all the way out into the larger ecosystem. And so that bullying that's going on in that high school, which led directly to the death of this young person, is still very much problematic. However, we're starting to see larger and larger community support building, particularly in Oklahoma, to address the issue. A friend of the show, Lance Preston, the founder and chief executive officer of Rainbow Youth, was on the ground in Oslo yesterday. And actually, he filed pictures that I used in our report about the counter-protest to Westboro. I was heartened to see so much support for the kids in that community, especially in that part of Oklahoma, which has had notoriously a lot of homophobic and transphobic rhetoric being flung around in the greater ecosystem, if you will. So we were looking at that. On another note that I think is kind of important is that we're still seeing a lot of committees and a lot of legislation in various state houses that are being directed against the larger LGBTQ community. Yesterday in Jefferson City, another bill was being debated by a Missouri House committee that would, again, ban drag. So we continue to see these issues. We continue to see this vitriol. And we really continue to need to stay on messaging and counter this. And with that, I'll throw it back to you.
Yeah, a couple points I just wanted to mention based on what you were just reporting. And thank you so much for that, Brody. Lance was on our show. So the Lance that you mentioned on the ground there, if you want to hear more of Lance, you can hear him in your own voice. Just listen to last week's episode of our show here. One thing that people have observed that is kind of an interesting underlier in terms of the elections that have just happened is there's a very large percentage of the Haley voters. You know, she didn't win anywhere, but she got, you know, oftentimes double-digit percentage and cut into Trump's lead where he won, where Biden was far ahead of that percentage where he won. But Trump's lead is in danger because half or a good portion of the Haley voters have declared they are not going to vote for Trump in the general. So that is some good news there. And Brody, you mentioned in the swing states, like a 52% delta. Does that mean there's like 20% of LGBTQ people that are actually going to vote for Trump?
We don't necessarily think that it's a vote for Trump. We think that we're going to see a lot of people just sit it out. There will be also some that will probably be voting for other candidates that will be listed on those ballots. But no, we haven't seen any trending towards voting for President Trump at all.
Good. Okay, excellent. And since our theme today is films, I do want to mention this Sunday is the Oscars. The Oscars are earlier than normal. They used to start at 5 p.m. Pacific time. They are now starting at 4 p.m. Pacific time. And because we have daylight saving time the night before, it's going to feel like it's 3 p.m. It won't be. It'll be 4 p.m., so watch your clocks. If you want to get a sense of, at least in my opinion, how the Oscars are going to go, check out my article in the Los Angeles Blade. I'll give you a hint. It's going to be about a bomb, the Atom one. So that is where I think they're going to go on Sunday, but it should still be a good show. And a lot of LGBTQ representation in the nominees. I don't think we're going to see them in the winners, however. But check out that article. Anyway, I want to pivot further into film, and this time we're going to go into documentaries, and one that is hitting theaters very shortly called Much Ado About Dying. And with that, I'd like to welcome the very talented filmmaker all the way from across the pond. Simon, welcome to the show.
Hi, Rob. Thanks so much. It's great to be on the show.
Oh, great to have you. And before the show, you and I got to chat for just a minute, and I told you that your film, Much Ado About Dying, which you created a brilliant legacy to your Uncle David, and audiences will both get to see him, know him, and love him through this film. I went through a few years ago caretaking for my senior parents. My mother had Alzheimer's and my dad had dementia, and kind of did a similar arc as you did with your Uncle David through to the end. And so the person I was watching most in the film was actually you. Even more than Uncle David. How did you feel after that experience with, saying goodbye to him?
Well, you know what? I never intended to make a film. And what was funny, so Uncle David was an actor, not a famous actor, but a theater actor, and he loved Shakespeare. And I have made documentaries, and I was living in India, and then my uncle kept ringing me up, as you were saying in the introduction, and saying, come back to London, I need you, I think I'm dying. And I knew that he's also a real drama queen, and I was quite used to that. But in the end, I did come back because a friend went around and said, yeah, I think you better come back. And so, the funny thing is, I don't know whether you felt like this when you were looking after your, when you were being a carer, but you kind of enter into it not really knowing what you're letting yourself in for. And you think, well, okay, somebody slipped over on the stairs. They need a bit of help for a few months. And then, what happened to me was I thought, okay, I'll come back to London. I'll sort him out, get everything back in shape, and then I'll go back to India. But then 1 year went by, 2 years went by, 3 years went by, 4 years went by. And it was like 5 years later, and I was still looking after my Uncle David. And sometimes, I felt incredibly resentful, and I thought, this guy's taken over my life, because it does take over your life, partly because you never know. You can't really plan anything. But then on the other side, you kind of end up with something that you didn't realize you even needed or you wanted by being a carer for somebody. And in his case, as you said, he's an extremely exuberant and kind of funny person. And also incredibly philosophical and playful. I think that's probably the main thing I got from him. And I guess when I was in India, before I came back, I was a little more serious about everything and, trying to be the serious documentary filmmaker. And then when I came back and looked after him, and like I said, I wasn't intending to film him, but he kept saying to me, why don't you, you need to get your camera out. I mean, honestly, what's your problem? You're a documentary filmmaker. And, I know that actors never feel more alive, really, than when they're performing. And so I did do that as a way of us getting on better, because sometimes he was a little cranky, and I'd be cranky with him as well. You know, like family members can be with each other.
Mm-hmm.
But then when I brought the camera out, he was much more, like, we got on better when the camera was there. And
oh, interesting.
After 5 years, yeah, after 5 years, I mean, he eventually did die, but he died a very good death. But after 5 years, I felt like I'd been through an incredible experience with him, ups and downs, a real roller coaster ride. But I got something out of it that I didn't really realize that I needed at the time. And I look at life a little bit differently now. You know, I think after we've had that kind of experience of being with somebody, you know, we start to think about our own mortality, about what's important and what's not important, and all those smaller things that we get so worked up and anxious about in our lives. They suddenly take on a perspective when you're dealing with the idea of, you know, what you want in your life and that you're going to die one day. It kind of puts it in perspective.
It did in such a big way. And I think that was part of it for me, watching the film. And, yeah, I went through everything you just described is, you know, I have a parallel to. It's, you know, it's like you don't know what you're getting into. You think you can just manage it and handle it. And then, you know, you turn and the person that you're caring for who used to be an adult in your life is now a child in your life. And, you know, it's like it, you suddenly have to re-gear that you're the grown-up in the room. And the weird thing for me was I had my two sons they were, I mean, like 10, 11 at the time with my folks. And I found this parallel where I would show them how to do things and they would learn how to do them and they would then go on continuing doing them better. I would show my folks how to do things knowing I was just doing it out of respect, but they weren't going to remember it. They weren't going to know how to do it after that. It was like, it was, you know, that kind of effort. But, yeah, it's like my dad was wandering around like, you know, like Uncle David's King Lear moments. He was inadvertently accidentally breaking into other people's townhouses, and the police were called a couple times, and I had to go pick him up at the police station. And my thing the second time, I was like, I looked at him and I said, you know, if I knew you were going to pull this shit when you got to be this age, I would have been a lot worse as a teenager. You had it so easy.
Yeah.
Like,
so, I mean,
what was your...
I mean, in my... Well, yeah, go on.
No, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, you talk about... You know, as we get older, we turn back into a child. And, I mean, Shakespeare says that. He calls it second childhood. And David sort of does a quote of that. But what makes it more complicated, really, is that these people have had independence. They know what that's like. The role that we have as somebody that's trying to care for them is trying to give not take any of their independence away from them, but at the same time, you know, trying to do what's best for them. So in the case of my uncle, there were lots of things that, as you see, if you see the film, that I'm trying to kind of keep on track, and then it doesn't work, and then there's a huge calamity as a result of that, which I won't spoil it for people that are going to come and see the film.
Right.
But, you know, how do you deal with that thing of somebody that has had independence and wants to carry on having independence? And you're saying, we can't cope anymore. We can't, literally, we can't cope. What are we going to do? And then the other thing that, talking about memory and, you know, like you were, the funny thing about David was he could remember whole plays. Like, he remembered the whole of Shakespeare, King Lear, but he couldn't remember where he put his false teeth. And so that created... frustrations, but also a lot of humor as well. And he'd do all these quirky, funny things, like the nurses would come along, because in England we've got nurses that will come and try to support older people. And they would bring a load of diapers along and sort of leave them, and they'd be in a hurry because they had to see another 20 patients that day. And then he'd say, come on, you know, I'm not going to wear those. Are you kidding? He used them for all sorts of things around the house, like for blocking up drafts under doorways. And he even actually used one as a, we call it a tea cozy in England. I don't know what you call it in America, but, you know, to put over your teapot to keep the tea warm. And so he was incredibly creative with all these things, and very funny about it. So we actually had a lot of fun, and the film, you know, it might sound like it's not going to be much fun, but actually it's very, very funny. And all the audiences, one of the things I love doing is going in at the end of the film and catching the last sort of 10 minutes. And the audience are laughing so much at, it's basically David. He's such a, I don't know where he, whether he made these things up or whether he'd heard them from other people, but he has the swamp quality about him and, you know, some of his humor. So, for example, when one of his best friends is in the care home that he's in at the end of his life, and the friend is talking about how he was very lucky to have a lovely boyfriend for 40 years of his life, and then the boyfriend died. And then my uncle was trying to console him, and he sort of said, oh, yeah, death. Well, it's like going on a wonderful holiday, but without any of the bother of having to pack. And I don't know where did he get these things from? But he's got lots and lots of quips like that. And then, like, 2 days before he actually dies, he's singing I Believe in Miracles, You Sexy Thing. You know, and he's doing like his own rap version of that. So it's a sort of, I found it incredibly moving, and in a way it's a beautiful experience and a very privileged experience to be with somebody if they're dying in a way, you know, from old age, and it's a sort of natural death, and it doesn't come at you too suddenly. I think it can be, you know, he said he wanted to have a good death, and that's what we tried to give him, and I think he did have a good death.
Yeah, it's he's such a character and so charming, and yeah, that one line about you know, it's like going on a holiday is actually really profound. I mean, it does, you know, it's humorous, but it does, when he says it, it's like you do sit back and kind of go, God, that's such an incredible outlook. It's sort of like when before Betty White passed away, somebody was interviewing her and she said, oh, I'm so excited. And it's like, what are you excited for? She goes, because then I'm going to know the answer. I'm going to understand what's going on, how this all works. You know, it's like, so this sort of refreshing optimism around it. What was your relationship like with him when you were younger, when he was the adult in the room and you were the kid? What was the dynamic like between you two?
So he was always this incredibly fun uncle to be with. You know, like, we were kids, so I'm 63 now. So do you remember when, I don't know how old you are, but we had suddenly these cassette recorders came out where you could press play and record, and you had a little microphone, and you could record things. So we did plays. Uncle David would say, okay, today we're going to do a play. What do you want to be? Okay, I'm a bear, a kangaroo, that kind of thing. And then we do all these, because he was a theater teacher in a kind of very progressive art school in England. And he did all that kind of stuff with his students. And, you know, they all thought he was great because he was that teacher that would sort of stay till 10 o'clock at night and help them rehearse their play and then go up to Edinburgh Fringe with them and, you know, help them with their plays and everything. Because, you know, he kind of lived for his students, and he loved hanging out. He always liked hanging out with younger people. And so he was a lot of fun to be with. And then I moved up to London, you know, partly because of me. We lived in the countryside in Devon on a farm, and I moved up to London, and then David and I would go to see lots of plays together. Was chatting. I was always having to get him out of little scrapes he'd get into. He tend to sort of fall in love with a plumber that had come to fix his, you know, bathroom or something,
mm-hmm.
and then something would go wrong, and I'd have to come and sort of sort it out. We both got on well because we also, you know, we're not straight. You know, I call myself bisexual, although I understand that's very untrendy now. But call yourself that. I have to call myself queer, apparently. But I've been told off for saying that.
Well, you don't have to. You're good. You're good.
Okay, I'm good here. That's fine. I'm not going to get told off. But so we both had that in common as well, that we, you know, we had a different idea. We didn't have that kind of sense of compatibility being so important. We created our own sort of chosen families around us. And we would sort of, we you know, we lived in the same city, but we'd only see each other every couple of months, probably,
mm-hmm.
until he got older, and then I would be taking him out to plays every couple of weeks. I'd take him out to a matinee play in the West End of London, which he'd always end up sort of talking when he wasn't meant to in the audience. He'd sort of tried to encourage the actors. And thinking, yeah, bravo, I quite agree. Yeah, you're quite right, too. Quite right, too. Yes, 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 yes. And I'd sort of shrink down in my seat and pretend that I wasn't with him.
That's too funny. So was he in any way, I mean, he didn't come out till later in his life, right? He wasn't, like, out and gay early on, correct?
Well, that's right. I mean, no, he tells a funny story in the film about his first sort of gay experience, which was when he was at university, I think. So he was young, you know, he was like 20 or something like that. And, you know, the way he tells the story, it's actually quite funny in the film, because it all starts when he says to me, oh, I couldn't possibly share a bed with somebody else, could you? And I say, yeah, yeah, of course I could, yeah. And he's saying, oh, golly, no, I don't know. And then he talks about this guy called Douglas and how they ended up kind of just acknowledging. Because you've got to remember, this would have been in a time when it was illegal
right.
to be homosexual. And so they both sort of go, oh, yeah. Because they're both from... they're both talking like that and say, oh, you know, oh, I'm queer. Yes, I am too, you know. Oh, really? Okay. And then he says that Douglas sort of went off and disappeared for a little while and then came back in a kind of silk dressing gown and all perfumed. and then they went on from there. But then he kind of kept quiet about it for the longest time. He never wanted a partner or a boyfriend. And he, you know, I remember his mum, my grandmother, always just like, you know, for the longest time, she just thought he was a bachelor and he wasn't interested in all of that. He was much more interested in the theater.
Right.
But then when he was about 55, he came out to the family. And I think he'd come out to other people, friends before that. He certainly had, you know, I think he was worried about coming out to his mother, who was a very staunch but loving Christian. And, you know, I think he was worried about, he was worried that she'd be worried, I think.
Right.
You know,
I
don't think he was worried that she would sort of disown him or be incredibly disapproving. But I think he thought she'd worry that he might, you know, be lonely or whatever. I don't know. So anyway, he came out when he was about 55. And then he actually acted in one of the very first lesbian and gay LGBT theatre groups that was called Gay Sweatshop, and they did loads of stuff in the 80s. And it was quite an exciting and new thing then. There was a very good gay playwright and director called Noel Gregg, and they had a kind of troupe of LGBTQ actors, and they did loads of shows, and they always cast him as a sort of older man.
What do you think is the impact he had on you growing up as somebody to look up to? I mean, you seem very parallel to him in a lot of ways, although your theatrical talents are potentially more subtle, where his are right there in your face, that you create a stage and an environment and drama in front of you. But you also, like him, were inspired by nurturing younger people. I mean, you started out, working with youth and before you got into film, with disadvantaged teenagers. It seems like that him coming before you potentially gave you a touch point.
Definitely. I mean, yeah, absolutely. And you know what? It was so important to have somebody like that. At the time I didn't think he was a great influence, but I don't know how you feel, but sometimes when you, like I said, I'm 63 now, when you look back on your life, you see it kind of differently, and you can see all the influences that you had that at the time you didn't think were influences. But because we used to argue a lot and bicker politics and that sort of thing, even though I'll have to say we were both very left-wing and, on the same wavelength politically, really. But we would have little bickering arguments. But looking back, we're both incredibly humanistic and wanting to help people. And we're brought up in an environment where, that's just what you do. It's not like if your uncle is saying, help, I need you, then you go and try and sort it out,
mm-hmm.
and you drop everything else.
Mm-hmm.
You drop your film and all of that, because actually that's more important. And I do believe that this kind of caring, it's one of the least valued things that you can do in the world, but it's actually one of the most important things. It should be valued a lot more, and care should be paid a lot more money, because it's a very difficult, challenging, very important job. And so with David, I got that sense. He was a humanist, and I think I'm a humanist. And, really we're the kind of art we like the plays, the films, they're all about really exploring humanity and
mm-hmm.
believing in that there is a lot of good in humanity, and looking at the good in humanity, and that it's funny, because when people see me in the Q&As at the film, they go, oh my God, you're just like your uncle. And I would have hated that. 20 years ago, I would have hated someone to say that. But now I actually find it quite reassuring in a funny way. I don't think I'm quite as funny as him. Well, I don't think there's space for two people to be funny like that. Let's put it like that.
Well, but yeah, and also you need your own brand and your own uniqueness in that. It's I see the level of talent, where somebody could observe that. But, I mean, he was pretty much of a character, and you seem a little much more down to earth and in touch.
Well, I think I'm more practical than him.
There you go.
I'm definitely more practical, I can sort of sort things out. He would end up forgetting to get off the train when he came to see us at Christmas time, and we'd always have to go down to the next railway station, which was about another 20 or 30 miles down the track and pick him up. And there was a story about how he was on stage once. There was somebody that dropped out or they were ill. He knew the part, and he said, oh, I'll do it, I'll do it. And then he had to get this costume together really quickly. And so he ran down to the market and bought some trousers and some shoes and everything for the part that he was going to play. And then there's a bit where it was a very serious bit where he ends up dying, and he has to sort of keel over and sort of fall to the ground. And then he was surprised when all the audience started laughing, because it was a very serious moment in the play. And what had happened is he forgot to take the price tag off the bottom of the shoes that he was wearing. And so he was always doing funny things like that. But he would always see the funny side of it, you know. And we always used to laugh about all these things. There was a time when he locked himself in a wardrobe. And he couldn't get out. And then he was banging on it. And I was there. You know, he's that kind of person. A bit like a mad professor who, you know, knows everything about quantum physics but doesn't know how to tie up his shoelaces, that sort of thing.
Right, right. Well, the parallel I see with you is, you know, it's like you're in India, you're making a film, you know, about cars in India and everything else, and then all of a sudden you get this message from him and you pivot, and now you're making a film about him, which is just so unique and above and beyond what anybody else has made or will make. And it's just sort of, it's like you both have this ability to, you know, take what gets handed you and just, you know, create on the spur with it. So, you know, so it's that.
Well, that's very sweet of you to say that. But, you know, I mean, I sometimes think, you know, people say, well, as a filmmaker, what is it you're really trying to do? And I mean, this—if I was had to be put on the therapist's couch and ask that question, really, you know, it sounds a bit pathetic. But all I really want to do is I want to move people, or move the audience. I want them to laugh. I want them to cry. I want them to be moved. I want them to think about things in a different way, and. I think, you know, with this film, I feel very pleased that I think we've done that with, and it's mostly thanks to my uncle, the character who's in the film, because he does what I think actors, when they're doing, you know, what's an actor's job? And an actor's job, if you think about it, whether they're in a movie or if they're on a stage, their job is sort of to reflect and that reflect our hopes, our fears, our the way we're living. And he does that in bucket loads in this film,
mm-hmm.
you know, and especially when he's, you know, he's getting a bit frail and he's he knows he's going to die soon. And he's sort of talking us through it like he, you know, he's going, oh, I feel I'm in a state of bliss. I've never really felt like this before because I've always been too busy living my life to understand it. But now I look back and it all makes sense to me, and I can feel, I feel a sort of a peace because I feel that it all makes sense to me.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, wow, that's actually an incredibly beautiful thing to give an audience, isn't it?
No, totally. And it's interesting because where he's the actor and he kind of breaks down the fourth wall, I see that parallel in you as a documentary filmmaker, because in both this film and your previous film, Every Good Marriage Begins with Tears, you kind of go beyond what a lot of documentary filmmakers do in the fourth wall of the documentary. I mean, like for me, in this film, you are, even though you're off camera, you are an active role in this film. And in fact, I, like I said before, you know, because of my history and my situation, I actually was very empathetic and very much in tune with your emotion in this film itself. But in Every Good Marriage Begins with Tears, you are you become like the family friend that they're talking to in the film. And, you know, what is it that allows you to do that in your work?
I suppose what I feel is, you know, David was an actor and he got up on the stage. I could never do that. I feel, I wouldn't be able to remember the lines for a start, but I would really want to. I'd love to stand up and do something like that, but I don't think I ever could. I'd just be too fearful. And so this is a way of bringing myself in, in a slightly less kind of stark way. And I also feel that, you know, when people make documentaries about other people, I often think it's a little bit unfair that they show all the kind of, you know, the traits of another character, and it can be very fascinating, but they don't show themselves, and they don't reveal anything of themselves. And I kind of feel that it's only fair that I also make myself vulnerable. And so I did that in both those films that you mentioned. You know, I make myself vulnerable and make the questions, you know, the situations make me ask questions of myself, like, what am I, you know, how do I feel about getting married, and would I ever do that, and would I ever want to have a long-term relationship, or how am I going to feel when I get to that age? So I only feel it's fair to make myself vulnerable in the way that David's also vulnerable in the film. And I think actors, you know, good actors give a sense as well, vulnerable sometimes. You know, okay, they have a spectrum of emotions, and they can be vulnerable, they can be strong, indomitable, whatever. But yeah, I think I'm trying to be fair. And then the other thing is that as a man, I feel that men don't do that often enough.
Mm-hmm.
Men don't make themselves vulnerable and don't show their feelings and talk about how they feel. And so I think it's important that people do that.
I think it makes how you do it in these films makes it very special, because there have been a lot of documentaries I've watched where something unexpected and dramatic, you know, in the subject's life or whatever they're filming happens. And, you know, that is a question I have as the audience is like, hey, you holding the camera, how do you feel about that? Look at what you're observing. What's your reaction? It's almost like watching a dramatic scene in a movie and you only get to see one of the actors in it, you know? So it's, you know, it is a unique thing and a unique part of your brand in this. One other thing I also loved in the film was I actually loved the King Lear references. I think they came up a couple of times, and he does some lines from King Lear. But it's like there was something about the inclusion of that made the Uncle David's experience feel more, not only just universal of people now, but it's like every age goes through, every time period, people living in each period goes through this. It's, you know, our end of life are actually classic, you know, it's part of a shared humanity. What was your feeling about bringing Shakespeare in? Obviously, you know, him as actor.
Well, I think you're right. I mean, I hadn't quite thought of it like that, but I think you're right. The Shakespeare does bring a kind of universality to it, as though it's a bit like the Bible, you know, the stories in the Bible, they bring a universality. But, you know, it's, I mean, David lived his life. Shakespeare was so important to him. And I've got to tell you, Rob, that, you know, unless I've been told what the story is, I can't understand what the hell's going on when I go and see a Shakespeare play. I have to do a Wikipedia on it, like, before I go. Then I go, oh, I get it. Yeah, okay, Romeo and Juliet, they fall in love. So I don't get it all, and but David sort of introduced me to it and made it easy for me to sort of get it and understand it. And the thing about King Lear is that King Lear is precisely about a man who's getting old and losing his grip a little and letting things go, making a few mistakes now and again, and trying to sort of come to terms with the fact that he's getting old and everything. But it's done in an incredibly melodramatic way and, you know, over-the-top way. And then what I realized when David was doing these speeches, because he didn't just do Lear speeches. One day it would be Henry V, and another day it would be Falstaff, and another day, you know, he kind of knew all the plays. So I just picked out the King Lear bits because I think you're right. It gives it a kind of, makes it archetypal or universal mm-hmm. in some way, and it becomes about old age generally rather than just about one man who is sort of getting old, who is Uncle David.
Right.
And it was really quite fascinating because when we've shown this film now in maybe 25 different film festivals around the world, and when we were in Poland, this middle-aged man came up to me at the end of the film and he said, you know, I've just got to tell you, I'm an actor. And I've got no idea if he was a well-known actor or not, but he said, I'm an actor, and I just want to tell you that that's the best King Lear I've ever seen in my life. And I think what he meant was David's real life and the mm-hmm. bits of acting that he did as well. You know, that they kind of, you know, they really do describe what I think Shakespeare was talking about with the real play. But what David does, which is so funny, is, you know, right in the middle of an ordinary, he'll be doing something. Like there's a bit when he's in the hospital and he has to take his top off, or his top of his pajamas off, and he takes them off, and I think he's just in his shorts or something. And then he just goes into Shakespeare and he waves his hands around with a naked top and he says, what is man? Nothing but a bare-forked animal, which is something that King Lear says. And then a nurse comes in and he goes, oh, sorry, I put my clothes on again. And he's always doing stuff like that. And then when he starts going a bit crazy, there's a bit where he closes it for a few days in the film. And then he's in the hospital. And then he says, oh, yeah, this is Act 3, Scene 2 now. You know, like he's seen his whole life as a play. And I think there's something to be learned that we can all learn from that. I've certainly learned something, which is,
don't
take your life too seriously.
I relate to what that actor said, though, because when he is delivering the lines of King Lear, it's like he's King Lear in that moment in the film, and it is like so authentic. I mean, it's like the whole of the King Lear play played in my mind, you know, behind him. You know, it's like he really did hit it. I mean, you know, because it was him. You know, it was like I think that observation is absolutely right on target. I want to do a little housekeeping on the film, though. It opens next week in New York, next week on the 15th in New York City. And then the Los Angeles premiere is on March 22nd at La Mille's Monica Film Center. Where does the film go after that?
So then we're going to start our UK release after that. It's at the Film Forum in New York City, which we're so delighted about because it's, you know, they're very picky about the films that they choose for that place. So we're very pleased. And I'm going over in a few days' time, I'm going over to New York. And so we'll be there for that. Yeah, then, like you said, it's at the Lemley, Santa Monica. And then after that, we're in UK, and we're doing a tour around cinema. And we've got this thing called Dying Matters Week, where we're actually starting to talk about dying and death, because it's such a taboo. We don't talk about it. We don't want to talk about it. We like just kind of think, okay, we'll deal with that when we get there. And so there's a Dying Matters Week in the UK. And so in the UK, at the beginning of May, we're going to be doing a tour around, you know, some of the cities and the art house cinemas in the UK. But apart from that, we don't have any plans. So we don't have you know, it's not going on television or anything as far as we know yet. We're still waiting for someone to come along and buy it if they want to.
Yeah, I'm sure they will. What is up next for you? Are you working on anything else currently?
That experience was a very sort of emotional and tough one. I'm actually working on helping someone else on their film now, because it's quite, you know, it was a very personal and difficult project. Actually, I have to say, you know, it was 70 or 80% caring and like 30 or 20% filming. So,
right.
You know, it was mostly caring and having to like, okay, I've got the camera here, but today we need to sort out clipping your toenails. And that would, you know, it wouldn't take, like, I can clip my toenails in about 5 minutes, but it would take 2 hours or something, because it would be a lot of talking and a lot of this and that. So, yeah, it was mostly caring. And I did feel it's a very emotional film and the emotional subject. And I don't, like I said before, I make myself vulnerable in my own films. And mm-hmm. I'm not really ready to go there again yet. I need to build myself up a bit. So I'm working on other people's films and doing a bit of teaching and that kind of thing. And then, you know, maybe in a couple of years maybe I'll make another film. Who knows? Who knows? I might
end up having to care for my
mother.
We'll be there for you. Unfortunately, we are right out of time. And Simon, thank you for being you. Thank you for the film. Everybody, you know, try to catch it if you're in those cities. And if you're not, I am very confident it will get on a streaming service in the future. But thank you for being you. Thank you for being here with us today. And for our listeners, we'll be back again next week, same time with something new. And we will talk to you then.
You've been listening to Rated LGBT Radio!